This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. America's founders were pretty clear about not wanting a state-sponsored religion, and the separation of church and state remains an important principle today. But, of course, that doesn't mean religion has no role to play in politics. In fact, some people feel driven to political activism because of their faith. The Kenan Institute of Ethics at Duke University is hosting a series of talks on religion and politics and political and public life. We're going to talk about that today, the intersection between religion, politics, and globalization this hour. Joining us now are Luke Bretherton. He is an associate professor of theological ethics at Duke, and Ibrahim Musa is a professor of religion and Islamic studies at Duke, and they're faculty leaders for the Religions and Public Life Initiative. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So tell us about this initiative. Luke, maybe I'll put the question to you first. Why hold this series?
Well, it's important. I think one of the curious things, I've moved here from London, and obviously we have an established church in British context, and a lot of public religiosity, state opening of to Parliament, begin with the religious service and these kinds of things. One of the striking things about moving here is this very religious country. Obviously, we're in the Bible Belt here, but a strange kind of strongly secular public space, supposedly, and yet lots of religious passions motivating why people get in. And so you get this curious thing is actually there's quite low, it seems to me, religious literacy, of understanding how to interact with public life and bring one's religious passions, convictions, beliefs, practices into the public sphere. And yet it's going on all the time. And this seems to provoke a lot of misunderstanding, both in the university and then more broadly. So one of the ideas of the course really is both to raise up the religious literacy elements, but also in the context of the university to say religion isn't confined either to the kind of leisure pages of the tourist brochure or to kind of religion departments and divinity schools. But actually, if you're going to understand the environmental issues and why some people are either for that or against it, or if you're going to understand issues around public health to do with AIDS and sex education, or to do with broader issues of development and humanitarian work, then actually taking the religious dimension seriously is an important part, not only of understanding the public sphere, but of actually doing academic work as well. So it's raising a flag in the university to say religion, it relates to all sorts of areas of research and work. And also we as a university have a public duty to help people understand this often very tense and contested area of life.
Well, Ibrahim, let's talk about that in terms of the academy itself. Duke University is founded as a religious institution, and so allowing Duke to speak for the academy in general nationally, what is the role, or why is this conference important to understanding the role of the academy in the face of the religious impulse?
Yeah. I think that the academy needs to and wants to be relevant to the world in which it's living. And so the idea of having an insular academy and ivory tower kinds of meditations about things that doesn't relate to real life societies is something that the academy is fully aware of. And so you see this in science and technology debates. You see that in high school curricula. Questions about the place of evolution, or is it going to be, the question of design, or is it the question of creationism and those kinds of debates. But also, furthermore, there's a global and international dimension to this. And whereas, say, a newcomer religion like Islam is fairly controversial in some places in the United States from developments, what happened in summer of 2010 about a mosque being built, or the idea of building a mosque in downtown New York, or developments in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, to questions of religion and politics in Pakistan, Afghanistan, in the Arab Middle East, and how that affects national security and global security, developments right now in Mali, where actors who are ostensibly religious are engaging in all kinds of activities that give rise to all kinds of questions about what is the nature of religion and what is the nature of politics. So bringing all those kinds of things into the classroom and keeping it under perspective and examining it with a dispassionate manner, but also looking at it with a certain amount of empathy, that why is it that religion tends to come and play such a fervent role in times of crises? And what is it about religion?
And it always has. I think, Luke, one of the more interesting things is that for most of human history, at least the history of civilization, the two have never been separated, and no one ever considered separating religious life from public life. It's only a kind of recent development, right?
I think it's a striking feature of the kind of modern world, as it were, that we think we can separate out. And obviously it's a bit peculiar, particularly intense feature of American life as well. But one of the reasons for having the course is there's been often a big assumption in the academy and more broadly in the media and amongst kind of public administrators and things, that the idea of modernization, this idea of bureaucratization, industrialization, urbanization, all these terribleizations that we, you know, sociologists lay on the table, but that will inevitably lead to a decline in religious belief and practice, or if not just that, the public, more properly, the public significance of religious belief and practice. And that is many now see as not true and not right. And so people are having to rethink, well, how do we think about law and doing things in common, building a common life? And it's not just religion as some amorphous thing that is, you know, all versions of the same kind of thing. It's actually that there are real differences between Christians and Muslims or Jews and Hindus. And actually then how they interact, how they relate, and the building of a common life or a public sphere between these very different patterns of belief and practice and understanding their interactions and constructive ways of doing that. That's a very important task of our time if it's the case that religion doesn't necessarily disappear as we all get richer and healthier and consume more.
It's interesting to see, Ibrahim, the way these tensions cut both ways. The minute you separate religion from public life, you have tension on the one hand. Will science, will technology and modernization erode our religious impulse? On the other hand, science worries that religion will intrude on its ability to do research and make the advances and developments that they think, as scientists, they need to do. So the tensions cut both ways, don't they?
No, absolutely. They cut both ways, and they are very problematic, and I don't think we have a good solution to that. So I always say that we need to work those tensions because we are not just entirely our bodies, but we are also our souls. Some people say, what are souls? There are going to be those kinds of questions. And so we have audiences who believe in these kinds of things, and we need to then make sure that as thinkers and as scholars, we cater to those various kinds of needs and examine it in a proper manner.
On the state of things today, Luke Bretherton is an associate professor of theological ethics at Duke. Ibrahim Musa, a professor of religion and Islamic studies at Duke. They are the faculty leaders for Religions and Public Life series. Coming up next, we'll talk to Jose Casanova about why religion is so relevant today. Stay with us on the state of things. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about religion and public life. What role does and should religion play in politics, globalization, and our public lives? With us in the studio, Luke Bretherton is an associate professor of theological ethics at Duke. Ibrahim Musa is a professor of religion and Islamic studies at Duke. They are the faculty leaders for the Religions and Public Life Initiative. And joining us now by phone is Jose Casanova. He's a professor of sociology at Georgetown University. He's going to be speaking as part of the Kenan Institute for Ethics Initiative on Religion and Public Life. That happens February 19th. Jose Casanova is on the line with us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You talk about the year 1979 in terms of public life in the United States and our understanding of the role of religion in politics. 1979, you say, is a dramatic year. It had a dramatic impact on the whole world as far as religion and politics. What happened?
Well, 1979 only. I mean, we were not aware then, but in retrospect, 1979, you have four developments that, of course, themselves had a longer preparation, but had very, very wide global consequences and effects. This was the year of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. We're still living with these aftershocks. This was the year of the Nicaraguan Revolution, in which liberation theology play a crucial role, the transformations of Catholicism throughout Latin America, culminating in the Nicaraguan Revolution. This was the year of the election of Wojtyla, the Polish Pope, as Pope, his first visit to Poland that led the next year to Solidarity, which of course you say is the beginning of the end of the Soviet system, and of course we are still living with these aftershocks. And this was the year of the emergence of the moral majority in electoral politics in the United States. This was the year, of course, of electoral politics that would culminate with the election of Ronald Reagan that had also important political effects in the United States. And since then, the so-called Christian right has been a very, very important element, a faction within the Republican Party. So in this respect, it really brought religion back into politics, electoral politics, in a way that had not been for a long time in the United States. But if you link this development with parallel or other coincidental processes elsewhere, then you have a sign that something is happening around the globe, and that religion, something that nobody expected, is actually playing crucial world historical roles.
So it's interesting. This is the year where religion has an overt impact on politics. It raises its head as such and says, we as religious actors are playing a role in this. But to what extent had religion played that role anyway? I mean, you talk about the politics in Latin America, and that obviously was directly connected with religious life in Latin America.
Right. And again, it's very important that we tend to essentialize and say religion does that. Religion doesn't act, doesn't think, doesn't interfere. It's always people. Religious, we should use religious as an adjective, so religious people, religious institutions, religious movements, religious ideas, but not religion, because then we simply are in a situation in which we have an idea what religion is. And our global condition forces us, I mean, even the mention of these four radically different events, and of course we link all of them having something to do with religion, but this forces us to really have a very broad global comparative perspective and a long-term historical perspective. After all, let's say if we mention Islam or Catholicism, let's say in Latin America, those are religions with a very long history. They were transnational religious regimes before the nation state. And now, with globalization, is to a certain extent loosening the boundaries of the nation state. Religions around the world, religious identities, religious groups are also becoming transnational forces, transnational dynamics, so that they all, in the same way that governments, states cannot control anymore markets, global markets, the flows of ideas, media, they cannot control or bound religion anymore in clear kind of spaces where religion belong or does not belong. So we are, all these boundaries are being loosened up and being contested everywhere, because we are all in flux. I mean, look at even this panel. Here you have a British professor, a professor from a scholar of Islam from South Africa, myself, a scholar of Catholicism from Spain, discussing religion in public life in the United States. This is a symbol precisely of the kind of global condition in which we find ourselves. And in this respect, it's very important to have this very, very broad global comparative and historical perspective on these matters.
So when we talk about the confluence of the religious impulse in this year, 1979, one could take the mystical view that this was destined to be, that the religious impulse would not be thwarted and was going to find its way back into the world in 79. So let me go around the panel here and talk to you, start with you, Luke. In a sense, what's happening? What are the forces that are causing this to happen, at this time in the tail end of the 20th century?
Well, I think part of the issue is the kind of coming a cropper, as we say in England, the coming up against the bumpers of a whole set of secular, if you like, ideologies. Think about the coming to grief of the European Marxist project, which the John Paul II represents, and the Solidarity movement motivated strongly by Catholic and strong alliance with the church. Think about the kind of recalibration of that Marxist project in Latin America with liberation theology. We're kind of seeking on new sources and a broader, that we aren't just material political animals. There's something more to human life. that can't be simply got at through economic life or technological advance. Again, in the context of the Middle East, various projects of nationalism, the kind of end of the Ba'athist move, or various forms of nationalist liberation movement, and then the return of Islam. So we have the kind of coming to grief of various forms of secular modernity, but we make the mistake of thinking that equals the end of the secular as such, that actually what we're seeing is a reconfiguration, a reconstruction of what it means to be secular, where actually religious beliefs and practices in myriad forms can play a role. And that's really the big debate we're in America. Do we have a completely a secular sphere swept clean of religious belief and practice? And that's part of the reaction the moral majority said, no, we don't. We're uncomfortable with that. And I think there's a good instinct there. But then how do we have a common life where different religious beliefs and practice can be part of the conversation, and you don't have to leave who you are at the door to enter the room? And that's a big contemporary debate. Ibrahim?
Yeah, in most places you find that the key trigger, the trigger event, is a certain amount of political discontent, that people are unhappy. And so when you see in 1979 in Iran, Iranians feel oppressed by the Shah, and they are mowed down in the streets. You see this in South Africa in the 1990s, 1976, young people are mowed down in the streets. In the 1990s, religious communities get together, form national, interreligious alliances, go out in the streets and protest. So it's often time that there is a certain way about how people feel. It's what we call the aesthetics of how human emotions are. And then people lose the fear of the state. And I think in many ways, in Iran, for instance, one scholar put it that people fear the state now, even after liberation. In South Africa, but they don't fear in Iran to go out on the streets where they might be safe on the streets against criminal violence. In South Africa, people are no longer fearing the state, but they fear criminal violence because there's social anomie. What I'm trying to say is that the most often the question is a certain kind of discontent. Or in affluent societies like the United States, where people might feel that there's too much materialism in their lives and they want something else. So that trigger is one of discontent, and it finds and manifests itself in very different ways. They worry about the future of their children. What kind of human beings will they be ushering into life that might have a mindset of theology or mindset of science that they do not feel comfortable about? And therefore, they want the return of religious values into their life. In Latin America, a different set of questions about poverty, distribution, those kinds of questions are oftentimes the main issue. So it's very... Very often it is the everyday things that really ruffle people's feathers and get them out.
And it's true, isn't it, that even ancient religions, when religious and political life were one, would find themselves in crisis when the theory just wasn't working anymore. The priests were able to deliver the rain, and when it stopped raining, all of a sudden there's a religious crisis even in the ancient religion. So is that a little bit, Jose, let me put the question to you, what we're seeing today, that the religion of secular scientific rationalism wasn't paying off the way it was, and so now we're scrapping around, searching around for a new way to reconstitute ourselves?
Well, yes, but I don't think that the issue was so much scientific rationalism. I think it's that even in Europe, Western Europe, where there is no religious revival whatsoever, of course, the only new religions are the immigrants. And religions, but you cannot talk of a religious revival in Europe, and yet a prominent scholar and thinker and public intellectual like Habermas, Jürgen Habermas, the German philosopher who was the great theorist of secular modernity, has begun speaking of post-secular societies. Now, post-secular doesn't mean that people are religious again, but only that are reflexively questioning what does it mean to be secular. Certainly to be secular, when we talk, I'm a secular, Well, secular what? A post-Catholic secular, a post-Lutheran secular, a post-Confucian secular, a post-Muslim. Now, those are radically different forms of being secular. So the notion that we know what secular means was problematic. Yes, the United States and France had secular states. Those were the first modern secular democratic states. And yet, the model of secularism, the way in which they separate church and state, religion and politics, is radically different. Turkey and Senegal, two Muslim societies, took the model of laicism, laïcité, laïque, from France. But their model of laicism, or laïcité, in Turkey is radically different from the French, and Senegal is radically different from both, from Turkey and from France. So the point is that we are beginning to question what does it mean to be secular. Secular certainly does not mean or a secular public sphere. Doesn't mean one free from religion, but precisely one open, a pluralistic one open to all worldviews, religious and non-religious, so that neither any particular religion has the hegemony and excludes other religious views or other non-religious views, nor secular people, so-called secular, which are supposed to be more rational than the religious people, exclude religious people into the public sphere. So very clearly, the idea of secularity, which is gaining ground in our global age, is one in which you have a neutral state open to all worldviews, in the same way you can exclude Marxian worldviews or utilitarian worldviews or Kantian worldviews. I mean, those are very different kind of ethical worldviews. So we should not simply enthrone these worldviews as being more rational than other religious ones. So the question is, we are challenging this notion that the secular is what comes after religion. And actually, in our global age of religious pluralism, we have to incorporate an idea which actually is very close to the original American idea of no establishment at the state level, but free exercise at the society level, in civil society. And this is the idea of precisely an open public sphere, open to all religions and all worldviews. So it is this, I think, rethinking of what secularity means, which to a certain extent is post-secular in the Habermasian sense of being reflexively not thinking anymore, that the secular is a state that comes after religion, and we have already reached this state, and somehow religious people are not there yet. So it is this radical rethinking, I think, that is part of the reason why everywhere the boundaries that we thought were clearly cut in public life and where to place religion are being questioned everywhere, from China to India to Turkey to France to the United States, everywhere.
Luke? Yes, so I think Jerzy makes a very, very important point. So one of the issues is, are we really seeing is it really a process of secularization, or is it actually the issue of pluralization? And I use the image sometimes of this shift from a kind of showerhead model where there's a single source and a single direction to culture. We're all moving towards some secular, we all know what that means, future. That's being questioned, as Jose very eloquently points out, to actually it's a jacuzzi. Everything's bubbling up from everywhere. And we can look at the kind of Dawkins-esque confessional Darwinists as much trying to make sense of this, and a kind of they thought the world was going their way, and suddenly they're having to kind of be very virulent and assert themselves, as well as the moral majority as well. Everyone's trying to kind of make sense of a highly pluralized context, and everything's bubbling up from everywhere, and everyone's feeling discombobulated, as it were, by this plurality. And that's the kind of time of negotiation we're in at the moment.
Well, we'll talk about this. We'll take a break here and come back and talk about whether pluralism and tolerance are enough, and whether or not that really slakes the thirst that we have for something deeper, something bigger, whether or not this new secularism is we're reaching the goal that perhaps we're urging toward. Luke Bretherton. Bretherton is the Associate Professor of Theological Ethics at Duke, Ibrahim Musa, Professor of Religion and Islamic Studies at Duke, faculty leaders of the Religions and Public Life Initiative, Jose Casanova, professor of sociology at Georgetown. Just ahead, Nancy Petty, pastor of Pullen Baptist Church in Raleigh, talks about religion and political activism at the local level on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour about the intersection of religion and politics and public life. With us in the studio is Luke Bretherton. He is an associate professor of theological ethics at Duke. Ibrahim Musa is a professor of religion and Islamic studies at Duke. They're faculty leaders of the Religions and Public Life Initiative. We're talking about that today with Jose Casanova. He's with us by phone, a professor of sociology at Georgetown. He's going to be speaking as part of the Kenan Institute for Ethics Initiative on Religions and Public Life. And that happens February 19th. Joining us now in the studio is Nancy Petty, pastor of Pullen Baptist Church in Raleigh. Nancy, welcome to you. Good to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've been listening to this conversation about the intersection of religion and politics. This is something that you are actively engaged in as a pastor and someone who's been involved in some of the political struggles here locally. So how do you see your role and how do you see your religion playing part in public life?
Right. First, I want to offer a word of gratitude to the two professors for sponsoring this series. I think that religion in political life of our society can be a very healthy thing when it engages people in dialogue. And I think that is what you're trying to do, is to engage people in dialogue that fosters respect and tolerance. I think when religion in public life becomes divisive is when we start using it to support our specific ideology or our political party. And I think that's where a lot of the rub has come today in our society, particularly here in the South, as we try to talk about religion in public life, is from where are we beginning that conversation? Is it going to be a dialogue, or is it just going to be a back and forth on what our political views are? I think it was Karl Barth that initiated the thought that preachers are to stand in the pulpit with the newspaper in one hand and the Bible in the other. And that's the way I understand my own role in this conversation of religion in public life, is that we don't separate out the two when we come into the sanctuary on Sunday morning or when we go out into our workplace on Monday morning, that the two in some ways must exist with one another and complement one another, and what we do on Sunday morning must inform what we do the other 6 days of the week and vice versa. And so my personal political activism comes out of my Christian principles and what I believe to be the ways in which my faith calls me to live in the world, not to be apart from the world. And so for me, that means that I have to take seriously my role as a civil citizen just as much as I do as a citizen of God's kingdom, God's realm. And those two must in some way come together for me if I'm to be a whole person living in this society.
Does it further complicate the struggle, though? You, for instance, were very active in the fight against Amendment 1 mm-hmm. here in North Carolina. There are other pastors who read the same Bible you did and said they came to the completely different conclusion, that under no circumstances should people of the same sex be married. It says right here in the Bible. And then it becomes a religious and a public fight. Is that for better or for worse for all of us?
Yeah. I think it's for the worse if we just stay in our individual corners, slinging our scriptures at one another. I think it can be a healthy thing when our differences in how we read the Bible and how we think about our personal convictions when it comes to our faith, if those places can bring us into dialogue with one another. And I think around Amendment 1 issue all across North Carolina, that conversation brought people together on both sides of the issue to have real conversation with one another. And I think people's lives were changed. I don't know how many minds were changed, but people's lives were changed by hearing the personal experience of someone else and how they understand how they're created in the image of God and what that means to them. I think it's the preachers who often spar the loudest and are the least inclined to really sit down and talk with one another and have respect and tolerance for one another. But I witnessed all across our state as I went to community forums on Amendment 1 how people sat in a room and listened and engaged one another. And I think that to me is the goal of where we need to get with this conversation around how religion shapes our public and political lives.
Jose, let me ask you if that's what you see happening. In other words, you talked about this the new secularism being a kind of pluralism where all ideas are allowed to proliferate and then compete in the marketplace, if I'm characterizing your ideas clearly enough. Is that how you see it playing out, sort of issue by issue, where these tensions, religious tensions, tend to play out in a very pointed way and somehow resulting in this new order?
Well, actually, I think that look at the history of the United States will tell us that in every conflict, in every political transformation, you had pastors and ministers and religious people on both sides of the barricades, even from the same denominations. We know the over independence, over abolition, over women's rights, the civil rights. You have ministers on both sides. So this has been part of the American political reality. People, religious people, disagreeing on fundamental issues, how to organize American life, American politics, American society. What was new in the United States and was beginning looking like Europe was the so-called culture was between secular people and religious people. This was something new in the United States. And I think it's very healthy now that this division has been precisely also to a certain extent changed, because it's not anymore only the Republican Party that uses the voice of religion. You have Democrats using it. So in the last, let's say, even in the election, in the Obama the elections that brought Obama to the White House, it was the Democratic candidates, Clinton and Obama, using religion, while the Republican candidate, McCain, didn't use religion at all. So this is actually, I think, healthier than the notion that there is a secular religious divide that presents a rather a situation which, well, it could happen. It could happen that too much and problematic when religions become uncivil when they enter public life, then a lot of people, maybe, and young people, are turned off by this kind of uncivility brought by religious people, and then they may also turn away from religion. So this is a new dynamic, perhaps, that we are witnessing in the United States.
Well, Ibrahim Musa, another, it seems to me, idea that this raises is that, you know, sort of this conflict among Christians about what the Bible says about gay marriage, for instance. But here in the United States, Islamophobia driven in large part by our God's better than your God. I mean, the sense and God is the ultimate authority and not rational. So can we have a rational conversation that brings us to this new understanding when our religious impulse is fundamentally irrational? God said so and you can't prove it. And that's as far as I'm going to take the argument.
Well, to be rational assumes that you have a certain amount of free will. And I think education is one of those things that might give you that ability to make a free choice. So oftentimes I think it's a lack of information, lack of knowledge of the other that creates these very strong barriers of misunderstanding and the idea that, you know, a senior general, Jerry Boykin, can say that, you know, when he engaged in a conflict in Somalia, he's told the opposition leader of the Somalians that, you know, my God is stronger than your God. That was during the George Bush era that this event came up. And so oftentimes you see our soldiers, for instance, going to the battlefield with certain kind of religious war cries that they have emblazoned on their T-shirts or when they write on the bombs that they send off. So there is clearly this notion that somehow the divine is on one side. But your adversary also believes that he or she has a divine on their side. And therefore, I think Jose is correct that this is now a question not so much religious versus secular, but religious versus religious and different kinds of religions that are emerging. And that one of the things that we're experiencing now is a certain kind of pushback of a certain kind of excess of the late 19th, early 20th century, that there's only one kind of model by which governance can be done, and that is to have the religious, the public sphere completely emptied out of religion, at least theoretically. In practice, it never was like that. So I think in some ways this is a North American a European problem. Many other parts of the world, obviously through colonialism and so on, had to accept those models, but those societies really didn't do that well with those models. India is a very good example. South Africa is a very good example. Nigeria, a good example. Yes, now when people look at India, Nigeria, and South Africa, they say, oh my gosh, can't they just be secular and then all the religious problems will go away? No, they won't go away. It's just not because of that you're going to get a strong government that's going to solve the problem. So what we are realizing that as Muslims, for instance, believe that you must have deen and dunya, that you must have salvation through the world. That in so people live in the world with a certain kind of purposes. Yes, governments can advance their purposes or government can obstruct their purposes. And depending what it's going to do and the intensity of how government obstructs them or the public sphere obstructs them, they are going to react. And therefore, we are seeing a series of reactions today in different parts of the world where religion or culture, we're not very clear, for instance, is the Arab Spring, for instance, motivated by religion or not, but we see a very important religious party taking power in Egypt. We are really worried about what's happening in Syria, where we see kind of very, very forceful religious actors engaging on the side of the rebels and so on. So I think there's a lot of fervor and we don't know how these chips are going to fall, but clearly there's something in the air that tells us that the question of the place of religious actors in society is yet to be determined. And I think we are going to be in for a very interesting time in the 21st century.
Luke, is there something essential about that something in the air? In other words, as secularism seems to have thrown out the baby with the bathwater, the idea that humans seem to have been reduced to their material stuff, both in the materialistic world of capitalism and in the Marxian totalitarian world, so the impulse to bring religion back, can we put a finger on it? Is it an impulse to restore awe and wonder and mystery, however you define it, wherever you think it comes from, or not? Is it something else?
That's often been a move. We talk about the sublime or the holy. Rudolf Otto is a big scholar, kind of, that we can look at the religion, reduce it to some substance. I take a kind of more prosaic, slightly more basic view. I think it's really about love and justice and how do we have a common life. And, you know, secular forms of we've had various kind of secular ideologies which have said, well, we can throw out love and we have these substitute notions like altruism or humanitarianism or the Soviet man and woman. But these turn out to be very thin. And they don't really get at this quest for relationship that, you know, how am I going to make sense of dealing with the struggles and cherishing of children, bringing up children? How am I going to make sense of my need for community? How am I going to kind of come together around grief? How am I going to bury people? How am I going to birth people? You know, these ideas, these are very kind of basic human, seemingly very mundane things, and yet they're very rich, they're very profound, they're very meaningful. And that sense of having a meaningful life with others and the place of love as a public thing, the place of justice, the place of politics, the negotiation of a common life around competing views of what the good is. This is always, in a sense, part of what we might call religion in terms of how do we make sense of the world within a larger frame of reference.
I wish we had more time, but I think this conversation is going to continue for years and years to come, and I appreciate all of you being on the program today. Luke Bretherton is an associate professor of theological ethics at Duke, Ibrahim Musa, professor of religion and Islamic studies at Duke as well, faculty leaders for the Religions and Public Life Initiative, Jose Casanova, a professor of sociology at Georgetown University. He's going to be speaking at that initiative on February 19th, and Nancy Petty's with us as well, pastor of Pullen Baptist Church in Raleigh. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more about the initiative, you can go to keenan.ethics.duke.edu. That's our program for today. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.